All right, this is the fourth part of Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America, written by Leonard Peikoff, first published in 1982. I think one of the best accounts of telling us today what he knew 20 years ago about where we've come and why we've come to be what we are. Pervaded by attacks on every idea and method essential to the function of the reasoning mind, the cultural atmosphere of the Weimar Republic was an invaluable asset to the Nazis. They made full use of it, taking from their surroundings whatever epistemological doctrines they needed in order to implement their irrationalist approach, assured in advance of a receptive mass audience. Of these doctrines, two in particular were emphasized by the Nazis, the combination becoming a characteristic leitmotif of theirs. One of the doctrines is age-old. The other is an offshoot of Romanticism. The first is dogmatism, and in parentheses, the advocacy of faith in immutable revelations. The second is pragmatism. The concept of faith does not pertain to the content of a man's ideas, but to the method by which they are to be accepted. Faith designates blind acceptance of a certain ideational content, acceptance induced by feeling in the absence of evidence or proof. It is obvious, therefore, why Nazi and fascist leaders insist on faith from their followers. Faith, writes Hitler, and this is a block quote, faith is harder to shake than knowledge. Love succumbs less to change than respect. Hate is more enduring than aversion. And the impetus to the mightiest upheavals on this earth has at all times consisted less in a scientific knowledge dominating the masses than in a fanaticism which inspired them, and sometimes in hysteria which drove them forward. All right, moving on in the text. In the West, the stronghold of the demand for faith, the institution which issues that demand in the most sophisticated manner, is the Catholic Church. Send all your hate emails to Leonard Peikoff. Hitler accordingly admired the Church. He admired not its teachings, but its methods. Quote, its knowledge of human nature, unquote. Its hierarchical organization, its discipline, its uncommonly clever tactics. One of its cleverest tactics, he believed, is its unyielding dogmatism. Faith, he explains in Mein Kampf, must be unconditional. It cannot in any essential way be made dependent on arguments, proofs, reasons. Its content must be offered to the masses in the form of rigid dogmas, dogmas as such. Once a doctrine has been announced publicly, therefore, there can be no changes in it, no debates, no discussion. It's a quote. For how shall we fill people with blind faith in the correctness of a doctrine if we ourselves spread uncertainty and doubt by constant changes in its outward structure? This is again Hitler. I have followed the Church, he told Rauschning, in giving our party program the character of unalterable finality like the creed. The Church has never allowed the creed to be interfered with. It is 1,500 years since it was formulated, but every suggestion for its amendment, every logical criticism or attack on it, has been rejected. The Church has realized that anything and everything can be built up upon a document of that sort, no matter how contradictory or irreconcilable with it. The faithful will swallow it whole so long as logical reasoning is never allowed to be brought to bear on it. Holy mackerel, is that a mouthful? All right, back to the text. Dogma, whether Nazi or otherwise, requires an authority able to give it the stamp of an official imprimatur. The Nazi authority is obvious. Goering writes, just as the Roman Catholic considers the Pope infallible in all matters concerning religion and morals, so do we National Socialists believe the same inner conviction that for us the leader is in all political and other matters concerning the national and social interests of the people, simply infallible. Hitler's authority derives from something mystical, inexpressible, almost incomprehensible, which this unique man possesses, and he who cannot feel it instinctively will not be able to grasp it at all. Then back to the text. Given their commitment to the method of faith, it is not astonishing that some Nazis went all the way in this issue. A tendency never given the status of official ideology yet fairly prominent in the movement was voiced in a demand made by several of its leading figures. The demand that Nazism itself be turned into a full-fledged religion. These voices urged the state religion supplanting the older creeds with its own symbols, its own rituals, and its own zealots, avid to convert Christians into fanatic Hitler believers, as, once, ancient missionaries had converted pagans into fanatic Christians. Adolf Hitler, exclaimed one such believer, is the true Holy Ghost. The Nazis did not survive long enough to complete this development. To the end, they could not decide whether to retain Christianity, construing Nazism merely as its latest truest version, and in parentheses, positive Christianity, this wing often called itself. All right. Or to concoct a distinctively Nazi creed out of a hodgepodge of elements drawn from pagan Teutonic mythology and Romanticist metaphysics. In either case, however, whether advanced as a form or successor to Christianity, what Nazism did unfailingly demand of its followers was the essence of the religious mentality, an attitude of awed, submissive, faithful adoration. A quote from Dr. Robert Lay. We believe on this earth solely in Adolf Hitler. We believe that God has sent us Adolf Hitler. And he said this to an audience of 15,000 in the Hitler Youth. 17 centuries later, Tertullian, one of the church fathers, had explained that religion by its nature requires the subversion of reason, the belief in the irrational because it is irrational. He had delivered a ringing anti-reason manifesto declaring in regard to the dogma of God's self-sacrifice on the cross, quote, it is believable because it is absurd. It is certain because it is impossible. If Tertullian's is the correct view of religion, the Nazis were evidently qualified to enter the field. The absurdity of their dogma matched anything offered by the medievals. The other half of the Nazis' epistemological leitmotif, the concomitant of Nazi dogmatism, is the Nazi pragmatism. To grasp the relationship between these two halves, one must first grasp the nature of pragmatism, including its philosophic roots. Those who regard the intellect as cut off from reality tend to regard the man of intellect as an impractical theoretician who is impotent to act or achieve goals in the real world. According to this viewpoint, a fundamental dichotomy cuts through human life. Thought versus action. Intelligence versus achievement. Knowing versus doing. The know-it-alls, states Hitler, are the enemies of action. In elaborating this idea, the Nazis repeat most of the voluntarist commonplaces of the latter Romanticists. The essence of human nature, they say, is will, which they regard as man's means of access to reality and as the ultimate source of human action. Will, in this context, means a set of blind, irrational drives that crave an outlet, and Nazism means giving them one. It means the triumph of the will through a life of blind, irrational action, action unmediated and untouched by the operation of intelligence. The voluntarist worship of mindless action may be designated by the term activism. Activism is the form of irrationalism which extols direct physical action based on will or instinct or faith, while repudiating the intellect and its products such as abstractions, theory, programs, philosophy. In a very literal sense, activism is irrationalism, inaction. Says Hitler, we approach the realities of the world only in strong emotion and in action. Men misuse their intelligence. It is not the seat of a special dignity of mankind, but merely an instrument in the struggle for life. Man is here to act. Only as a being in action does he fulfill his natural vocation. Contemplative natures, retrospective like all intellectuals, are dead persons who miss the meaning of life. And that's the end of the quote. Professor L.G. Tarala, a philosophically trained Nazi ideologist, sees beyond the obvious Romanticist sources of this attitude. He traces the Nazi activism to the two-world philosophy of Kant. Kant's view, he writes, is, and here's a quote, the essence of the world is richer and deeper than the world of appearance. The world of activity and action is subject to different laws from the world of appearance. This primacy of action, of the world of action, in the case of Kant, especially the world of ethical action, arises from a primary predisposition of the Aryan race, which does not derive from the quibbling, hair-splitting intellect. All Teutonic men of science have acknowledged this truth more or less consciously in a primacy of action over pure thinking. The deed is all, the thought nothing. Unreservedly accepting such a viewpoint, Nazis and fascists alike frequently state that it is a matter of indifference whether the doctrines fed to the masses are true or false, right or wrong, sane or absurd. Leaders in both movements are content, even proud, publicly to describe their own ideologies as myths. A myth, in the Sorelian fascist Nazi sense, is not a deliberate falsehood. It is an ideology concocted for purposes of action, without reference to such issues as truth or falsehood. It is addressed not to man's capacity for reason, but to a mob's lust for faith, not to the fact-seeking intellect, but to the feeling-ridden, action-craving will. We have created our myth, states Mussolini. The myth is a faith. It is a passion. Our myth is the nation. Our myth is the greatness of the nation. That's the end of the quote. Ours, writes Rosenberg in his best-known book, The Myth of the 20th Century, is the myth of the blood, the belief that it is by the blood that the divine mission of man is to be defended. The advocacy of myth is one form of a more general epistemological position that had come to dominate much of the philosophic world by the latter part of the 19th century. Thinkers for decades had been saturated with the Kantian view that facts in themselves are unknowable, and with the voluntarist view that action is primacy over thought. As a result, a growing chorus, helped along by Schopenhauer, Marx, and Nietzsche, among others, began to suggest that men should dispense with any concern for facts or reality. Ideas, it was increasingly claimed, all ideas, are merely subjective tools designed to serve human purposes. If, therefore, an idea leads an action to desirable consequences, that is, to the sorts of consequences desired by its advocates, it should be accepted as true on that ground alone, without reference to the unknowable facts of reality. This new approach reaches climax and found its enduring name in America, in the writings of William James. James called it pragmatism, truth independent, truth that we find merely, truth no longer malleable to human need. This, says James, is what the pragmatist dispenses with. This is a quote. The true, to put it very briefly, is only the expedient in the way of our thinking, just as the right is only the expedient in the way of our behaving. Both fascist and Nazi leaders embraced the new approach to truth eagerly in their advocacy of myth and in other even more explicit forms. The standard by which ideas are to be judged, Hitler says repeatedly, is not abstract considerations of logic or fidelity to fact. The standard is usefulness to the Volk. Every thought and every idea, every doctrine and all knowledge, he writes in Mein Kampf, must serve this purpose and used or rejected according to its utility. Then, no theory will stiffen into a dead doctrine. What are the non-pragmatists concerned for the truth, the objective truth of an idea? All right, one student of the movement writes, many apparent Nazi absurdities, exaggerations, or eccentricities must be ascribed neither to ignorance nor stupidity or even vindictiveness. They arise from a primary and more or less conscious disregard of objective truth. For the only function of cognition in political and even philosophical matters, as they see it, is to equip the fighting nation and the leaders who mold it with the most effective weapons possible. There is no such thing as truth, explains Hitler, either in the moral or in the scientific sense. Or as Goebbels puts the point, important is not what is right, but what wins. The corollary of such an attitude is unceasing intellectual flux. Pragmatism leads to relativism. An idea, the pragmatist holds, must be judged as true or false according to its utility in a particular situation. What works today in one situation need not work tomorrow in another. Thus, truth is mutable. There are no rigid principles, not in any field. There are no absolutes. The needs of a state, says Hitler, are the sole determining factor. What may be necessary today need not be so tomorrow. This is not a question of theoretical suppositions, but of practical decisions dictated by existing circumstances. Therefore, I may, nay, must, change or repudiate under changed conditions tomorrow what I consider correct today. The masses, Hitler told Rauschning, are ignorant. They have succumbed to the illusion that some ideas are absolutes. The initiates know that there is nothing fixed, that everything is continually changing. I tell you, declared Goering, dismissing a criticism of Hitler's economic policies, if the Führer wishes it, then two times two are five. It is instructive to note that Goering's statement can be taken interchangeably as an expression of pragmatism or of dogmatism. In their dogmatist capacity, the Nazis demand blind faith in a creed allegedly revealed to the Führer by God. In their pragmatist capacity, they stress action, expediency, and change more than God and faith. Not infrequently, these two epistemological elements come into clashing contradiction in the Nazi formulations. Nazism is the revealed truth. There is no truth. Nazi pronouncements are immutable. There are no absolutes. The creed is sacred. It is a convenient myth for practical purposes, and so on. Observe that Nazis give no evidence of being disturbed by this clash. One of the reasons that is that the clash was somewhat concealed, since the two elements were to an extent addressed to different audiences. The first was aimed primarily at the mass public, the second at the inner elite. The masses, Hitler explained to Rauschning, need something for the imagination. They need fixed, permanent doctrines. This, however, is not a full explanation, inasmuch as the Nazis propagated large doses of each element side by side, both publicly and privately. A deeper reason is that the Nazis boastfully rejected Aristotelian logic with its demand for intellectual consistency and were therefore untroubled by any contradictions. But the overriding reason lies in the fact that the clash is trivial. In fundamental terms, dogmatism and pragmatism are philosophically interchangeable. They are two variants of the same irrationalism, conducting the same assault on the human mind and on reality. The dogmatist rejects the intellect in the name of revelations from another dimension. The pragmatist rejects the intellect in the name of a flux of expedient myths. The dogmatist rejects reality, the reality men live in and perceive, avowing instead its allegiance to God. The pragmatist agrees, merely replacing God by the people, in parentheses, or the state, or the party. In both cases, and in both respects, it is only the rejection that is essential, in fact, in philosophy or to the Nazis. What the Nazi leaders primarily sought to achieve by means of their philosophy was obedience, the blind obedience of their followers and countrymen to the Führer. Judged by this criterion, the theory of dogmatism and the theory of pragmatism, singly or in combination, are unbeatable. One cannot seriously oppose a doctrine or an order except by reference to facts that one has observed and grasped. Qua dogmatist, the Nazi is eager to brush aside such facts in favor of faith in the supernatural, as relief to and by the Führer. Qua pragmatist, the Nazi denies facts, any facts, on principle, substituting social utility as his guide to truth, such utility to be determined by the embodiment and voice of society, the Führer. In both capacities, the Nazi is philosophically primed to hear and heed the same message, the one message the party leadership addressed urgently to every mind within range, the message expressed by Goebbels as follows. Quote, hear nothing that we do not wish you to hear. See nothing that we do not wish you to see. Believe nothing that we do not wish you to believe. Think nothing that we do not wish you to think. In essence, it made no difference in the Nazi leaders whether a man obeyed them for dogmatist or for pragmatist reasons because of his commitment to God in heaven or to the Volk on earth. What mattered was that he obeyed. But the Nazis preferred a man to obey for both reasons together. Dogmatism gave the Führer's words the aura of supernatural authority. Pragmatism gave him all the flexibility he could want. The combination made it possible to claim that, when the Führer speaks, his statement is a holy truth to be revered, until he contradicts it, whereupon his new statement is to be revered, etc. Thus the Führer unites the infallibility of God's representative with the nihilism of a Machiavellian skeptic, and a new phenomenon, new at least in its brazen openness, and as the world seen, the absolute of the moment, or the immutable which never stands still, issued by an omniscience that ceasingly changes its mind. After many centuries of religion and one century of Romanticism, most Germans were sufficiently trained in unreason. They were ready to accept the above combination, or, at minimum, one of its elements. These men were epistemologically ripe. They were willing or eager to regard Hitler, not reality, as their fundamental frame of reference. Dr. Hans Frank, Nazi Minister of Justice and President of the German Bar Association, speaks eloquently for this mentality, and this is a quote. Formerly, we were in the habit of saying, this is right or wrong. Today, we must put the question accordingly. What would the Führer say? Do abstract epistemological theories play a role in human life? What happens to men who learn, in church and in school, from early childhood on up, not to say, this is right or wrong? During the war, Hans Frank was Governor General of Occupied Poland. He was personally responsible for the massacre of thousands of Polish intellectuals and participated in the slaughter of 3.5 million Polish Jews. When a Nazi leader in Czechoslovakia hung posters proclaiming the execution of 7 Czechs, Dr. Frank declared boastfully, if I wished to order that one should hang up posters about every 7 Poles shot, there would not be enough forest in Poland with which to make the paper for these posters. Implicit in dogmatism and in pragmatism is a third theory, part metaphysical, part epistemological, and it's fundamental to the Nazi viewpoint. Subjectivism. In metaphysics, subjectivism is the view that reality, the object, is dependent on human consciousness, the subject. In epistemology, as a result, subjectivists hold that a man need not concern himself with the facts of reality. Instead, to arrive at knowledge or truth, he need merely turn to his attention inward, consulting the appropriate contents of consciousness, the ones with the power to make reality conform to their dictates. According to the most widespread form of subjectivism, the elements which possess this power are feelings. In essence, subjectivism is the doctrine that feelings are the creator of facts, and therefore men's primary tool of cognition. If men feel it, declares the subjectivist, that makes it so. The alternative to subjectivism is the advocacy of objectivity, an attitude which rests on the view that reality exists independent of human consciousness, that the role of the subject is not to create the object but to perceive it, and that knowledge of reality can be acquired only by directing one's attention outward to the facts. Objectivity, according to the Nazis, is a crime. It is the antonym of instinct, and therefore a crime against the fatherland. What Germany requires of its citizens, Hitler says repeatedly, and what Nazism offers, is not the dispassionate thought or even even-handed judgment of fact, but unbridled nationalist emotion, emotion based on will and clinging to faith or dogmatism or myth, pragmatism, emotion that concedes nothing to any antagonist, no matter what the caliber of his arguments. And Hitler writes, anyone who wants to win the broad masses must know that key that opens the door to their heart. Its name is not objectivity, but will and power. As for me, states Goering, I am subjective. I commit myself to my people and acknowledge nothing else on earth. I thank my maker for having created me without what they call a sense of objectivity. We are not objective, says Hans Schemm, the Nazi educator. We are German. Oh, man, is that scary. Western leaders could hardly have conceived of such statements in the 18th century. In our era, they utter them boastfully. The difference is the Romanticist movement. Although the theory of subjectivism was accepted in part by every important post-Renaissance philosopher, it did not achieve a successful sweep of the philosophic world until the appearance of the Critique of Pure Reason. Things in themselves, said Kant, exist but are unknowable. The world men perceive and deal with, the phenomenal world, is a human creation, a product of fundamental mechanisms inherent in the structure of human consciousness. On this view, it is the essence of the subject to create the object, and objectivity, as defined above, is impossible to man. It is impossible in principle by the very nature of the human mind. If so, the Romanticists concluded, we must reject the attempt to practice it. Objectivity, they said, like reason itself, is futile and harmful. The would-be objective man, they said, is detached, bloodless, and the like, whereas man should instead be warm, committed, vital. He should live and function under the guidance of a flow of spontaneous passion, uninhibited by facts, logic, or concern for external reality. There are two different kinds of subjectivism, distinguished by their answers to the question, whose consciousness creates reality? Kant rejected the older of those two, which was the view that each man's feelings create a private universe for him. Instead, Kant ushered in the era of social subjectivism, the view that it is not the consciousness of individuals but of groups that creates reality. In Kant's system, mankind as a whole is the decisive group. What creates the phenomenal world is not the idiosyncrasies of particular individuals, but the mental structure common to all men. Later philosophers accepted Kant's fundamental approach, but carried it a step further. If, many claim, the mind structure is a brute given, which cannot be explained, as Kant had said, then there is no reason why all men should have the same material structure. There is no reason why mankind should not be splintered into competing groups, each defined by its own distinctive type of consciousness, each vying with the others to capture and control reality. The First World Movement thus depluralized the Kantian position was Marxism, which propounded a subjectivism in terms of competing economic classes. On this issue, as on many others, the Nazis follow the Marxists, but substitute race for class. Racial subjectivism holds that a man's inborn racial constitution determines his mental processes, his intellectual outlook, his thought patterns, his feelings, his conclusions, and that these conclusions, however well established, are valid only for members of a given race, who share the same underlying constitution. One Nazi explains, knowledge and truth are peculiarities originating in definite forms of consciousness and hence attuned exclusively to the specific essence of their mother consciousness. What the hell does that mean? On this view, each race creates its own truth and, in effect, its own universe. There is no such thing as the truth in any issue, the truth which corresponds to the facts. There is only truth relative to a group, truth for us versus truth for them, German truth versus British truth, Nordic science versus the liberal Jewish science, etc. Men of different races, therefore, are separated by an unbridgeable gulf, an epistemological gulf, which makes it impossible for them to communicate or to resolve disputes peacefully. States Carl Schmidt, an alien may be as critical as he wants to be. He may be intelligent in his endeavor. He may read books and write them, but he thinks and understands things differently because he belongs to a different kind, and he remains within the existential conditions of his own kind in every decisive thought. And in parentheses, Schmidt was an influential political scientist and one-time communist who ended as a leading Nazi theorist. It is useless, the Nazis add, for men of different kind to turn to logic to resolve their disagreements because there is not only a different truth for each race, but also a different logic. There is not one correct method of reasoning binding on all men, they say, but many opposite methods, many logics, Aryan, British, Jewish, etc., each deriving from the mental structure of a particular group, each valid for its own group and invalid for others. This is the Nazi doctrine of polylogism. Thinkers of the same races and predispositions will again and again ask the same questions and seek solutions in the same direction, writes the philosopher Tarala, one of the most sophisticated of the Nazi polylogists. And therefore, even in the field of logic, he writes, as the foundation of all sciences, differences must be acknowledged which force thinkers and men of science to take a definite position, not only to think in this way or that way, but to work differently even in the realm of the purely formal. And that's the end of the quote. And back to the text. In presenting this theory, Professor Tarala gives no indication of the nature of Aryan logical principles, nor does any other Nazi. His concern is to denounce, not to define. What he denounces is Aristotelian logic. Subjectivism, in any version or application, is incompatible with Aristotle's laws of logic. According to Aristotle, everything is something. It is what it is, independent of men's opinions or feelings about it. A is A, the law of identity. According to the subjectivist, A does not have to be A. It can be whatever consciousness ordains. It can be A for one and non-A for another. It can be both A and non-A or neither, or both and neither simultaneously, if that is how men feel. To the philosophical defender of subjectivism, accordingly, the basic ideological enemy is far removed from the antagonist of the moment. The enemy is Aristotle. Aristotle, Tarala writes, is emphatically not an Aryan. Aristotle, and this is what he writes, was physically, according to reports, and spiritually, on the basis of his writings, to be judged as a representative of the race which is not capable of producing science. His Western soul is conformable to the magical world picture. The soul cannot understand the questioning of the Aryan spirit. Aristotle, the father of logic, regarded it as man's method of reaching conclusions objectively by deriving them without contradiction from the facts of reality, ultimately, from the evidence provided by the senses. The polylogist sweeps this view aside and turns logic into its antithesis. By rejecting the law of identity, he repudiates all cognitive standards, claiming the right, based on his logic, to endorse any contradictions he feels like, whenever he feels like it. Logic thus becomes a subjective device to justify anything anyone wishes. Logic, Aryan logic, becomes a Nazi weapon. In the beginning was the Führer who created the principles of inference. In the Nazis' attack on logic, all the major elements of their irrationalist epistemology, dogmatism, activism, pragmatism, relativism, subjectivism, blend and unite. Qua dogmatist, the Nazi holds faith to be superior to logic. Qua activist, he dismisses logic in favor of action. Qua pragmatist, he is free to endorse contradictions provided they work. Qua relativist, he rejects the absolutism of the law of identity. And qua subjectivist, the Nazi simply wipes out logic by giving its name to his random Aryan feelings. These theories may differ somewhat. The conclusion to which they lead does not. Nor do these theories differ in their practical results. To the dogmatist who cannot persuade others to buy his revelations, there is a decisive method of silencing unbelievers. Force. To the activist, the action to be taken is clear. Murder. To the pragmatist, the thing that works, if it is massive enough, is destruction. To the relativist, peace may have been a good thing yesterday, but there are no absolutes. To the subjectivists and racializers and polylogists, a bullet in the back is valid for you. On their own, the Nazis could not have begun to achieve what the intellectuals accomplished for them. On their own, the Nazis could not supply the thinking needed to undercut a country, not even the thinking that told men not to think. They could not supply the philosophy, not even the philosophy that told men to despise all philosophy. All of this had to be originated, formulated, and spread by intellectuals, ultimately by philosophers. But finding a country ready for them, the Nazis knew what to do with it. They knew how to add death-laden goose-steppers to the theory of unreason, and even what to call the combination, which was their version of the Zeitgeist. Goebbels and Rosenberg called it steel romanticism. These are times when not the mind, but the fist decides, declare Hitler in Mein Kampf. The philosophers had eliminated the mind and provided him with the times he needed. I need men who will not stop to think if they're ordered to knock someone down, Hitler told Rauschning. He had no trouble finding them. Epistemology had done its work.